mentioned, particularly coming out of the Soviet experience, and that is important to understand that we can't understand really easily, and that is asserting itself now on the world stage. So this is something, this is a way you can start to understand that.
So we've been talking with Lisa Neville and Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time about Andrei Tarkovsky's masterpiece, Yvonne's Childhood. Thanks for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is looking for a next membership director. KBOO's members are the heart and soul of our community, and we need a dedicated person to honor and foster this relationship. Are you the right person to steward and manage KBOO's membership department, or do you know someone who is? Then go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the membership director and the qualifications we are looking for. To apply, please email your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org by Sunday, March 6th at midnight. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Members make KBOO happen.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a one-hour special with Columbia University Professor of Psychology, Dr. Carl Hart. Dr. Hart is the author of a book entitled High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. In the book, Dr. Hart dispels many of the myths surrounding illegal drug use and reveals how misguided assumptions result in harmful policies like the war on drugs that have led to the mass incarceration of millions of mostly black and brown people. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Russian forces captured the strategic Ukrainian port city of Kherson and pounded the port city of Mariupol. The efforts appeared aimed at severing the country's connection to the Black and Azov seas. The Ukrainian military said a group of Russian amphibious landing vessels was also heading toward the port of Odessa farther west. Kherson is the first major city to fall as the invasion began a second week. In Mariupol, the relentless bombardment cut off water, electricity, and phone service. Food was running out. A column of Russian tanks and other vehicles outside the capital of Kyiv has made little progress in recent days. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed Russian land forces have stalled.
The missiles and bombs hitting our cities shows they couldn't achieve anything significant in our land. All our defensive lines are safe. The enemy doesn't have success with any of its strategic directions. They are disappointed and lost.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees said the number of Ukrainians fleeing their country has now risen to 1 million.
In just 7 days, 1 million people have fled Ukraine, uprooted by this senseless war. I have worked in refugee emergencies for almost 40 years. And rarely have I seen an exodus as rapid as this one.
Talks were set to get underway in Belarus between Russian and Ukrainian delegations. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Russia is ready for peace talks, but will press its demands to dismantle Ukraine's military infrastructure.
Of course it's bad when people are dying, the soldiers and civilians, as it's been happening in the Donbass for 8 years. We will find a solution, I am totally convinced. The minimum requirements are well known, and they were expressed in the last round of talks with the Ukrainians. The Ukrainian side had some reason to postpone those negotiations. Clearly, they are being ruled by Washington. We cannot expect Russia to allow any danger from the territory of Ukraine.
Ukraine is likely to press for the opening of a humanitarian corridor to bring in medical and other critical supplies. The International Criminal Court has launched an investigation into war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide during Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Separately, the UN's top human rights body is holding an urgent debate on the situation in Ukraine and the possibility of creating a panel to investigate human rights violations. Yesterday, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to condemn Russia's invasion. The vote was 141-5 with 35 abstentions. The House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection says explicitly for the first time it has evidence that former President Trump and his associates engaged in a criminal conspiracy. In a court filing, the committee says Trump and those working with him spread false information about the outcome of the presidential election and pressured state officials to overturn the results, potentially violating multiple federal laws. The 221-page filing marks the committee's most formal effort to link Trump to a federal crime. However, lawmakers don't have the power to bring criminal charges on their own. They can only make a referral to the Justice Department. The House committee made the claims in response to a lawsuit by Trump advisor John Eastman, a lawyer and law professor who was consulting with Trump as he attempted to overturn the election. Eastman is trying to withhold documents from the committee. The Senate Judiciary Committee says hearings for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson will begin March 21st. Democratic Committee Chair Dick Durbin announced the hearing schedule as Jackson held her first meetings with senators on Capitol Hill. The hearings will last 4 days, with opening statements the first day, testimony and questioning the next two. The fourth day will include testimony from outside witnesses. A Texas judge has stepped in to temporarily block state officials from investigating parents for child abuse if they help their transgender children obtain gender-affirming care. Roz Brown reports.
A Texas judge has temporarily ruled the state may not continue investigations of parents seeking gender-affirming health care for their child. Several groups sought the injunction after Governor Greg Abbott directed the state's Department of Family and Protective Services to investigate the parents. That followed a non-binding opinion from Attorney General Ken Paxton that certain types of gender-affirming care constitute child abuse in Texas. Ricardo Martinez with Equality Texas.
I never thought that I'd live to see the day where people at the highest levels of power in Texas would actively attack innocent children and in the process disrupt the loving homes of families who are trying to do right by their kids.
The court limited the temporary restraining order to the plaintiffs in the case, but scheduled a hearing for next week to decide whether to block the governor's directive more broadly. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
We now go to our one-hour special with Columbia University professor Dr. Carl Hart, recorded in June of this year. Dr. Hart, I've really been fascinated in looking at your work, as much of it as I've been able to go through. And I'll have to say I have learned quite a lot myself about it and have really been giving some thought to how widespread, how many areas of one's life, especially if one is low income, that these issues impact you. And as a mother, I'll just start with this particular example. We ran across a case of a young woman who was low income and pregnant, so she was under government health program. We found out that if you are low income and under a government health program, when you go into the hospital and you have a baby, they automatically drug test you
and I suppose the baby, without even you knowing anything about it. But if you have your own insurance and you're not under, that is not the case. And what happened to this young woman is that traces of marijuana was found in her blood. So the Department of Children and Family Services was called and they took her baby, right? And this isn't the first story that I've heard of such a thing. Just found out that in the farm bill that is now being considered in Congress, some conservatives have slipped in an amendment that says there should be suspicionless, without suspicion, drug testing of people before they get access to food stamps. So this isn't only an area that impacts incarceration per se, where there's a direct link, but it really spreads in many different areas of the lives of low-income people.
Yeah, I oftentimes am called to serve as an expert witness in cases in which you describe where the mothers test positive for something like marijuana during the birth of their children. And in New York, they do the same thing. They take away the kid and they test primarily poor women. Mm-hmm. And so I'm called oftentimes to testify. And they remove these kids. Even in the case where my last case that I testified, the mother had a child who had just finished college and then another child who was in the teens and now this infant. They removed the child, the infant, even though the mother children were doing well. The kid finished college. The teen was on an honor roll. And so they removed the child, despite the fact that all the parenting seemed to be appropriate. When the social services went to visit the house, eventually she got the child back. I mean, based largely on my testimony and some other circumstances.
Right.
But other women, they've lost their children in these sorts of cases. So one of the things that I try to encourage the courts to look at is the behavior of the parent. Are the children welfare being endangered? Those are the most important indicators because, as we know, marijuana, THC, stays in the system. It can stay in the system for several weeks. And it doesn't tell you anything about levels of intoxication or how well the person is parenting. It would be the equivalent of looking at somebody's sweat, for example, to see if they've taken alcohol and trying to determine what type of parent they are. It doesn't give you any information about behavior, and that's the problem.
So your work as a scientist then often takes you outside of your research outside of the academy and actually into these real life situation, like the case you just described, and I imagine that there are likely other instances as well.
Sure. You know, I do this pro bono, and I do this as my sort of giving back to the community. This is the way I give back, but few scientists actually do this kind of thing. Most of us stay in the lab, stay in the academy, without going out and doing this sort of social or this sort of service to the public. And so it's taxing. It's a lot of work, but I know if I don't do it, these sorts of things will go on.
Yeah, and the importance of that kind of pro bono and community work that you do, because other data have found that children who are removed from their primary caregiver and placed with strangers, the very young think they're kidnapped. These kids wind up with PTSD. In fact, they find that the PTSD levels are higher, perhaps even than veterans who have come back from war. And also that there is a very high percentage of children who have gone through that system that end up in prison. And then the whole industry that springs up around child welfare, where the parents, they say they find a little marijuana, they've got to go to this program and that program, et cetera. And all of that is money being used to keep the family apart, as opposed to resources that really attack the poverty and holding families together, helping to keep families together. I wanted also to talk a bit about you and about your family and your personal experience. You talk quite a bit about it in the book, Very Courageous. You expose quite a lot, and growing up and the trouble that you got into, et cetera. You do contrast what happened to you and somebody like your cousin Louis, for example. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that, about your growing up and why you didn't get involved in drug use.
Yeah, so there are a few differences in me and like my cousin Louis that I describe in the book. One of the things that helped me to stay as close to the straight and narrow path as possible, although you correctly pointed out, I certainly had my times of trouble, and I've certainly participated in activities in which I would discourage my own children from participating in. But one of the major things for me was sports. In high school, I played basketball all the way through high school, and I was required to maintain a 2.0 GPA, which is not that high, but
I was going to say that's all.
That's all, and that's all I maintained. That's all I maintained to make sure that at least I graduated from high school.
Yeah.
And so I was plugged in the mainstream through sports, and that was critical for me, whereas some other folks may not have activities that keep them plugged in. If it were not for sports, I wouldn't have graduated from high school, and I probably wouldn't be here talking to you now.
Mm.
Graduating from high school helped me to go on to eventually, I didn't get a basketball scholarship like I thought, but instead I went to the Air Force where I played basketball, where I went on to college as a result, where I got mentors. I left this country. I spent most of my time in England. Being in England was critical because being in England, I got corroboration of my American experience. And that experience is that racism was very real. And in the United States, it's oftentimes denied. But the British were comfortable in offering a critique of America based on the way we treated black people. I saw things like the PBS series, The Eyes on the Prize, over in England, had discussions about it over in England, and the British people were happy to have these kind of discussions and show these type of programming that looked at American racism. And so it corroborated my reality on the one hand, and it helped me to say, okay, I'm not crazy. Okay, I know how to think critically, and it helped me to think even more critically. And so that was an important sort of experience in my life to help me move on. Some kids back at home who I grew up with, they didn't have these type of experiences. The only place they had ever seen was South Florida. And when you're in...
Which is where you grew up,
That's where I grew up. And so...
A single mom and a rather large family.
Mom, seven siblings. And so when you have only that sort of experience, and then you have the society telling you that there's something wrong with you, you tend to believe it, and you tend to believe that the world is like that small experience. But the experience over in England with the mentors, with people telling me that I can think, that I'm not crazy, and those sorts of things, critical. Other folks back home didn't have those opportunities. And my opportunities came primarily because of athletics.
And likely it's a good thing that you went to England as somebody from this country, because certainly the experience of black people in England, they're quite happy to talk about the racism in the United States as opposed to the racism, you know, homegrown right there at home. But that kind of international, you know, exposure, I've heard that before, does have an impact. So sports helped you out. You did have the view, though, of drugs and addiction that have now changed. I mean, your views have evolved, you know, on this issue, even though you saw members of your family and people in your community devastated by things like crack cocaine and drugs and addiction.
That's right. I grew up believing that cocaine freebasing was the big deal when I originally grew up. And I grew up in Miami, and Miami was the cocaine capital at some point.
Is freebasing the same as smoking crack cocaine?
Yeah, freebasing is exactly the same as crack cocaine, except that during the early 1980s, people hadn't discovered the technology of adding baking soda and making it more quickly and readily, whereas before you had to use things like ether, which is highly flammable. Some people might recall Richard Pryor setting himself on fire. And he was freebasing, and he was, but he was using something like ether, which is highly flammable. So it's the same sort of thing. And when I grew up, people attributed other folks' problems to their cocaine use, their drug use, and that sort of thing. And I did the same thing. I just accepted that narrative without critically evaluating other things that were probably more important. So when you think about, for example, people had problems before they started using drugs. And a number of people who have problems after, say, the whole big cocaine scare. And start to think. Then I started to think that, well, maybe it's something else going on. And then I started to realize that the most of the people who use drugs like crack cocaine don't have a problem with it. And this is not to encourage.
By don't have a problem with it, you mean are not addicted, or would just break that down a little for us?
Yeah, so they're not addicted, and they can use cocaine on an infrequent basis and not be driven only by that drug use. They use cocaine in a similar way that people use alcohol for moments of myopia when they are they have their free time. The majority of people use crack cocaine in that way. And so when I started to see the real evidence and the data, it made me realize that drug addiction was more than about the drug itself. There are some important social things that are involved as well.
Right, and we'll talk about those. Our guest is Dr. Carl Hart. He has a brand new book, High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery, that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. And he recently spoke in Southern California and at the time came into studio so that we could have this discussion. Before we talk about the other problems behind drug use and drug addiction, there is the view of the differences between powder cocaine and crack cocaine. And there's also the view that, well, if you use powder cocaine, you won't get addicted. But if you use crack cocaine, it is so intense or so potent that just one use of crack cocaine and you're going to become an addict. I wondered if you would want to comment as to why there was more crack cocaine use, perhaps, than powder cocaine in inner cities.
You asked a couple questions. The first question is, I think to explain the difference between crack cocaine and powder cocaine.
Yeah.
So powder cocaine has this salt attached called the hydrochloride, whereas crack cocaine doesn't have the salt attached to it. The salt has no biological activity, no effect whatsoever. But when the salt is attached to the cocaine base, you can't burn it. You can't light it up. You can't vaporize it to be inhaled because the temperatures that are required to burn the salt are so high that the cocaine base decomposes. Now, when the drugs go into the body, the only thing that's active is the cocaine base. The cocaine base is what's in crack cocaine and what's in powder cocaine. That's the only thing that's pharmacologically active. So they're the same drug. The same drug.
It was a myth then that one is addictive and the other isn't?
Both are addictive. So that's not a myth. But the myth comes in where we say crack cocaine is so much more addictive than powder cocaine.
Okay.
It's not, because powder cocaine could be injected. And so it hits the brain just as quickly as smoking cocaine, like crack.
Mm-hmm.
So the addictive potentials are the same when taken by injection and taken by smoke. They're the same. One of the theories in drug abuse research is that the faster a drug hits the brain, the more addictive it becomes.
Mm.
So crack cocaine hits the brain faster than snorting or taking it via mouth, but not faster than injection. And powder cocaine can be injected. So their addictive potentials are the same. As a result of our misunderstanding, we punished crack cocaine 100 times more harshly than we did powder cocaine. Just imagine if we punished people who got caught smoking marijuana 100 times more harshly than those who ate it in brownies. That doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did basically with crack cocaine.
Why was that? I mean, the, you know, one argument is that, and I'm not quite sure if it was because crack cocaine was cheaper than powder cocaine, that it seemed to be kind of a, more of a drug of choice, no, or is you, that a myth in inner cities and it was more wealthier people that were using powder cocaine? And
it's quite simple. Why is it? Is because of a lot of the images that we saw on our television sets in the mid to late 1980s. Mm-hmm. And those images were of black people in the cities, in urban areas, smoking cocaine. About that time, 48 Hours on CBS was the most popular TV show ever in the history of television. Mm. And it was like a reality TV show where they show people like Rudy Giuliani, who at the time, I believe, was the Attorney General of New York, going out in the street to buy crack in these neighborhoods, in our communities, and those sorts of things. And those images bombarded the American public, and they saw black people smoking crack cocaine, and they believed that these folks were out of control. And our newspaper reporting was such, were consistent with the view that I just said. Time Magazine, Newsweek, in 1986, both of them ran at least five cover stories about crack cocaine. In fact, 1986, I think crack cocaine was voted by Time Magazine as the issue of the year. Ronald Reagan, in October 1986, labeled the month Crack Cocaine Awareness Month. I mean, ridiculous things like that.
And then the crack babies.
And the crack babies was a part of it. And we now know that was a myth. We know that that wasn't true. All of those kinds of things contributed to why we punished crack cocaine so harshly. But it's a myth to think that black people use crack cocaine at higher rates than their white counterparts. They don't. White folks use crack cocaine more so than black people. So all of these things contributed to us more harshly punishing crack cocaine. And it's really largely based on race. And to avoid stating it as simply and as plain as that is not being honest. And we haven't been very honest about this issue in the country.
Yeah, because drug use likely is higher among, I mean, if you look at the percentage of the population who are people of color or who are black, and the percentage of the population who are white, and then you look at who's incarcerated for drug possession, let's say, I mean, it is way out of whack on a racial basis. So clearly race and institutional racism has to do with that. So I just a quick comment for you on that. And then I'd like for you to tell our listeners the story of institutional racism in terms of what happened to you when you were, I think, a student, and the officers involved were officers of color.
Your point about the incarceration rate, black men make up about 5-6% of the general population. They make up more than 35% of the prison population. So now,
go figure that one,
We've always been at these high or these disproportionate rates in the prison system. But the drug war exacerbated that effect. And so drugs are just the drug policy serves as another tool by which we can marginalize this group. And that's a fact. Now, when we think about institutional racism, because that's what this is all about, I'm a black male, and so I'm not immune to this sort of thing. As you point out, when I was studying for my PhD at the NIH in Bethesda, Maryland, right outside of D.C., a lot of black folks. The National Institutes of Health. Mm-hmm. I was walking from one building to the next, going from the bank building to my building of where I worked. Two police officers approached me. One Filipino, one black, and they were looking at me. And so I said, "Can I help you?" And they said, "Yeah, you know, something robbery just happened, and we want to know if you can help us." "Oh, whatever. Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to help." Turns out I was a suspect, and I didn't realize I was a suspect. And as a result, I was subjected to an impromptu one-man lineup in which the person could see me, I couldn't see them, and they had to see if I was the person who actually committed this crime I had my NIH name tag around my neck. I had my bank statement, all of these kinds of things that any logical person could just say, this person wasn't involved. But no, we know how unreliable, as a psychologist, I know how unreliable one-man lineups are, or impromptu really? Lineups are. So I could have been taken downtown and subjected to even more inappropriate or
falsely
treatment.
Charged.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So you lucked out that the person actually said, no, he's not the guy.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah. That's only one incident that I mm-hmm. describe in the book. I mean, similar thing happened at University of California, San Francisco, when I was there. Looking like me in these spaces, people are just not accustomed to seeing us in these spaces. And so as a result, we must be there doing something that is inappropriate.
As I said earlier, our guest is Dr. Carl Hart, provocative analysis on the whole issue of drugs in society, challenging a lot of what the assumptions have been about drugs and the drug war and addiction, and wanting to get to that a bit and to your specific research. Because you do say that the addiction is overstated, the numbers of people who are addicted is overstated, and you draw a distinction between addiction versus controlled use, and you challenge some of the stereotypes of drug users and the assumption that people think if they're drug users, and I suppose talking now about what are considered harder drugs like meth or cocaine or heroin, that you are an addict. So how did you get to this point? What did you find in your research that led you to some of these conclusions?
Okay, so one set of studies that I did that challenged what I thought I knew about drugs was mm-hmm. one of the things that I have been told as an undergraduate student is that if you give rats an opportunity to self-administer cocaine, so you put a catheter in their vein and then you allow them to press a lever to receive an injection of cocaine, they will do so until they kill themselves. Sure enough, that was demonstrated in rats, primates, and so forth. But when you look more carefully at the data, you say, well, these rats were isolated. There was nothing else in these cages. What happens if you allow them to have some other options in their cages? For example, if you provide them with a sexually receptive mate, they don't do that. They choose the mate over the drug more oftentimes than not. If you provide sweets in their cages, sweet water, other sort of sweet snacks or fruit or things that animals love, they will choose these alternatives if you provide a running wheel compared with the drug. This will prevent them from killing
themselves.
They
had options.
They had options. Mm. If they have options, they're okay. So I thought that it'd be cool to see whether human crack cocaine addicts would behave similarly. Mm-hmm. So we did studies looking at providing options for crack cocaine users when they have a choice to take crack cocaine or these options. Options were escalating amounts of money or merchandise vouchers to purchase other items. When you do that, you could decrease or you can get them to choose other options. So
they could either pick the drug or pick getting some money or merchandise.
That's right. And okay. So what you find is just like the animals, they behave just like the animals. When options are attractive options are available, they will take these other options. And so it told me that my assumptions about what drug users or crack cocaine addicts were like was wrong, and that they responded just like anyone else to attractive options. They were not driven only by take another hit of crack cocaine.
Interesting, because the stereotype of somebody who uses crack cocaine is that they'll just do anything and any opportunity they have to be able to use that drug that they would. And your research has shown that that is not the case, in fact.
Not only my research, other people's research as okay. well. There is a plethora of data showing this phenomena that I just described.
So what has been wrong thus far with the focus of research in this area? you talk a bit about that in the book, about a lot of focus as to, on the decision as to why people are taking drugs, and on the craving for drugs. And that has fed, the findings of that has fed an entire industry that is also very expensive, and resources, again, not coming into communities that, quote unquote, are at risk.
One of the things that the listening public should understand is that my research is funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. The National Institute on Drug Abuse focuses on the bad things related to drugs, pathology. And they fund 90% of all the research in this area. Now, the National Institute on Drug Abuse should focus on pathology, because we want to make sure it's a part of the National Institutes of Health, and their job is to help us deal with diseases and pathology. And so it's not a problem. Their mission is not a problem. The problem is that there's a disproportionate amount of focus only on these bad things that happen with drugs. When the majority of the people don't have these things happening to them, it gives us a skewed perspective. And that is what has happened in the country. What gets published in our newspapers as a result of studies like mine, what gets published in the scientific journals, what gets published in the textbook, all of this is skewed towards pathology. And that's not representative of what happens in the larger sort of community.
From what you have found, then, that the other thing that I know I certainly was taught was that if you ever smoke crack cocaine, or if you ever shoot up heroin, you are going to become an addict. And you're saying that that is not the case. And sadly, we always have to say that your work is also not promoting the use of these drugs.
That's exactly right. Of course, what we're talking about, what you and I are doing, we're having an adult conversation, and we understand that we are not encouraging young people or anyone to engage in any illegal activity, because there are negative consequences. So that's a fact. But also a fact is that the public has been lied to, misled about these issues that you just raised, like one hit of crack cocaine, you're addicted. You're going to become addicted. There are a few absolutes in life, but here's an absolute for you. There is absolutely no drug that one hit of you will become addicted. Addiction requires work. When you look at the criteria for addiction, it requires a lot of work. So the notion that one hit of anything, it's so far from reality that I'm insulted as an educator that people would perpetuate such a myth.
Yeah, and it's still around today. And then you also have the images of withdrawal, of the person, you know, just, you know, in a ball and going through absolute torture, and that this is what will happen to you if you take a hit of this stuff.
Exactly. So you oftentimes see this image of withdrawal with something like heroin. Now, heroin, if anybody has experienced the 24-hour flu, they have experienced heroin withdrawal. It is not pleasant, but certainly not life-threatening, and certainly not as oftentimes described in the movies. Now, the one drug that we really worry about withdrawal from, worry about people actually dying from the withdrawal syndrome associated with this drug, is withdrawal from alcohol. That is the only one of the drugs that we've talked about that could actually kill you. You could die from alcohol withdrawal. I am not aware of anyone ever dying from heroin withdrawal. Certainly not from cocaine withdrawal, certainly not from methamphetamine withdrawal, certainly not from marijuana withdrawal. So the one drug we worry about death from with withdrawal is alcohol. And so, again, the public has been misled to believe that heroin withdrawal is so agonizing, life-threatening, those sorts of things. It's just not true.
Yeah, now, just pushing that a bit, people do die, though, from overdoses of these drugs. I mean, I've lost people. So that's a reality as well, isn't it?
No, it's a great point. One of the things I argue in High Price For, I argue that we have more realistic education. And you raised the issue of heroin withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 75% of the people who die from heroin withdrawal do so because another sedative was involved. And typically that other sedative was alcohol. Mm-hmm. And so that means that only a small fraction of people actually die from just heroin withdrawal. It's rare. I mean, it's possible, but it's rare. And so the public health message should be that if you're going to use heroin, don't use another sedative. If we blasted out that public health message, we could save so many people each year. But we haven't blasted out that message. Instead, people say they die from a heroin withdrawal. That's probably not the best message to tell people. The best message is don't combine heroin with another sedative. Because heroin overdose is unlikely when it's the only drug involved.
Uh-huh. So people who die then of, like a friend of mine who died of a heroin overdose, that likely there was something else involved in his system?
Likely there was another sedative involved. It's a very unlikely thing to happen that someone dies only from heroin.
Well, another myth there. Let me check that off of my list. In terms of, though, people... You talk about severe addiction. I mean, people who are addicted. First of all, tell us what you mean by addiction, like what the definition of somebody who is addicted, right? And what are some of the steps that somebody who is addicted can take? And what you have found, I mean, a lot of people get involved in like the 12-step program, for example. Somebody else I knew revealed that they were a heroin addict for 30 years. Very successful person in business, has now passed away, but not because of heroin, and was clean for a number of years, but went regularly, like every day, maybe even twice a day, to meetings following the 12-step program.
So when we think about determining addiction, we have this thing called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychiatry. It's the Bible of American psychiatry.
Okay.
And there are criteria by which we judge people to be addicted. They have to meet a certain number of criteria. These criteria can include physiological measures like tolerance or withdrawal, but they're not necessary. But the person must have had several attempts of trying to cut down their drug use. They have to have some sort of disruption in employment, education, that sort of thing, as a result of their drug use. They use, despite the fact that they have physiological or psychological problems as a result of their use. They may have multiple run-ins with the law. So a person has to meet at least three of these criteria within the same 12-month period. That's mm-hmm. how we define addiction.
Okay.
Now, when we think about getting out of addiction, there are a variety of reasons of different types of drugs that people are addicted to. For example, if someone is addicted to alcohol, they really should seek medical attention because of the concern about alcohol withdrawal and death.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think about something like heroin addiction, also medical attention is probably the best because we have medications that can help people alleviate withdrawal symptoms some even more so, and also medications to help people that people can use while they are trying to beat their addiction, trying not to relapse. And so when you think about something like cocaine, where withdrawal is not so much not the problem as much, there are no medications available, but there are treatments like cognitive behavioral therapy that's been shown to be effective. The same is true with methamphetamine. Marijuana, same is sort of true. There are a few people who meet criteria for marijuana addiction.
What is cognitive behavioral therapy?
So cognitive behavioral therapy is that you help people to identify various trigger points in which they, people, places, things that will increase the likelihood of their using, and help them to avoid it. If they can't avoid it, help them to deal with it, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on what drug people are addicted to, and they should really seek places that have evidence-based treatment approaches.
Right. So I wanted to ask about this, what is called a contingency
yes.
approach, as opposed to an approach like a 12-step approach? What's the difference?
So when we think about contingency management, it's okay. Just like cognitive behavioral therapy, similar sort of things, versus 12-step. 12-step, you described a friend, for example, who had been in 12-step for a number of years, and there's this notion that people say, well, I've been in recovery for 20-some years or so. And without any sort of critical thinking, like most of the people who've been in recovery for that long, they attribute their problems and to drugs, and they were young. They were young, dumb, stupid. And so we all did a number of things that when we were younger that we don't do now because we have matured, we have different types of responsibilities, a wide range of things. But yet people hang on to this label that I'm an addict. And there's no evidence to support that sort of thing. And so if you think about it critically, it probably wasn't the drugs that were causing you the problems, but people don't challenge that narrative because it appears to be insensitive. 12-step capitalizes on that, but that's okay. If people are happy to have a community and that community helps them in various ways, even yeah. more than drugs, that's fine. But the point here is that there's no evidence to support that it does anything for drugs. That's all I'm saying there. Now, contingency management, on the other hand, this is an approach in which people can use rewards to shape behaviors or encourage behaviors that are more appropriate. Like you get paid to have you get paid a small amount of money to have a drug-free urine. And you get paid additional money to learn these job skills, to be professional, to dress appropriately in the workplace. And so you're shaping up all of these behaviors that people never learned. It's kind of like what I do with my children. If you do well in your school, maybe you'll get a new computer. Maybe you'll get some video game you wanted or something of that nature. We all do it with our kids. So contingency management is a similar sort of, it uses similar principles and to help shape and train people with job skills, to help them to increase the likelihood of employment. But you also have to make sure that you are drug-free. And so you have your urine tested and so forth.
And has this approach found to be effective?
This approach is
contingency management.
Contingency management is arguably one of the most effective treatments for drug abuse. That, along with cognitive behavioral therapy, they're competing for being some of the most effective programs.
Our guest is Dr. Carl Hart, the author of a brand new book causing quite a stir across the country entitled High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. So, you know, if contingency management has the success, and I believe you, clearly the evidence is there that it has, why is it not promoted more? And why do you think, in your book, you talk about a concerted effort to overstate the dangers of drugs? Why do you think that is the case?
It's a difficult technique to use. So you need to have some very skilled, trained psychologists who understand principles of behavioral change. There are a number of people out here who are offering drug treatment, and they're just not qualified. So that's one reason. And another reason...
That's a whole industry.
That's right. That's exactly right. And also, it can be expensive in order to make sure you have the right rewards, the right items that will be competitive with drug use. And so I think those are the two major reasons that it's not used as much. Your second question was about... why do I think the harmful effects of drugs have been exaggerated?
Yeah.
The harmful effects of drugs are exaggerated, in my view, because it's beneficial to a variety of constituents to exaggerate the effects of drugs. Let's think about parents. If we think about parents, starting with parents, you simply tell your kids that drugs cause all of these horrible effects, and now you don't have to think. You don't have to tell, you don't actually have to know what you're talking about. It's easy just to say that.
It's a shortcut.
It's a shortcut.
It'll fry your brain. Don't do it.
Exactly.
That's it.
But you're not teaching your kids how to think, and you're not teaching them any critical thinking skills, and you're losing credibility. If they ever experiment, or if they have friends who've experimented, they'll find that that's not true. So you won't be trusted in those domains. Mm. But that's one. Another reason it's exaggerated is because it is beneficial for law enforcement departments to exaggerate the harmful effects of drugs, because the war on drugs, we put $26 billion a year into the war on drugs, and it most of the money goes to law enforcement agencies. And so if drugs are so horrible, pay us more money, increase our budgets so we can go after these horrible people. And so law enforcement benefits. Scientists benefit because if drugs are so horrible, we really have to understand the negative effects of drugs, these awful effects, to save the population and so forth. Not to say that science shouldn't be investigating and researching these drugs. They should. But what I'm saying is that they have a stake in the drug hysteria game as well, because their budgets, too, can be influenced by how awful we think these things are.
So there's a lot of money to be made here. Let's, in the time that we have left, we've got about 5 minutes or so, talk about policy. And you have talked about the difference between legalization and decriminalization, and I'd like you to say a bit about that, and also to give the example, talk about Portugal, where illegal drugs have been decriminalized, and what has been the impact, including on young people. I mean, I'm a parent. You're a dad, right? So everybody's always concerned about the young people and what will happen to the young people. What has been the impact in Portugal?
So the difference between legalization and decriminalization is this. If we think about legalization, we think about what we're doing with alcohol. Alcohol is legal. If you're 21 years or older, you can buy alcohol legally. People can sell it without fear of being prosecuted. Decriminalization, on the other hand, sales of the drug remains illegal. But what becomes different is possession. Possession is still illegal, but you can no longer get a criminal charge. Instead, you get charged with something like a traffic violation. And that way, people do not have a blemish on their record as a result of a drug arrest. We arrest 80% of our drug arrests in the United States are for simple possession. And so we would do away with those, with most of the sort of drug charges in this country. People will no longer have the blemish on their record as a result of a drug arrest. So Portugal has decriminalized since 2001. And what they found is that their drug use rates, their drug use overdose, and so forth, all of the major indicators, they're performing better than us in this country.
Including for the hard drugs. I mean, not just marijuana we're talking about.
Yeah.
About the quote-unquote hard drugs.
Right on. I'm glad you put the quotes around it, because there is no, the body doesn't distinguish. Only we do.
Yeah.
Yes, including for drugs like methamphetamine, heroin, all of the drugs, they're decriminalized. And that's what I argue for in high price. Mm-hmm. But I also argue for a corresponding increase in realistic education, not the hysteria, not the lies, not the myths, but the real sort of education. And we will need to have this corresponding increase in education to help keep people safe. So decriminalization would deal with this issue of mass incarceration that we are all concerned about, deal with this issue of decreasing the likelihood of black people, especially black men, making a contribution to the society. But the corresponding increase in education will decrease, or will help with keeping people safe and so forth. You mentioned an important thing about me being a father, for example. Now, I've been studying drugs for 22, 23 years now. One of the most important lessons that I've learned about my studies of drugs, in which I have given thousands of doses of drugs to people, one of the most important lessons is this. Drug effects are predictable. As you increase the dose, you increase the likelihood of toxicity. That's predictable. Mm. We know this. This is clear. So you encourage people, if you're going to use, please start with low doses. Don't take large doses because then you increase the likelihood of getting in serious trouble. That's one. Drug effects are predictable. Two, what I've learned also in my 46 years of living in the U.S. is that Black boys and Black men interactions with the police, however, are not predictable. And the war on drugs gives the police in a license, to so to speak, to have situations in which the young men typically or young men too often ends up dead. We think about Trayvon Martin, the guy who killed him, said that he must be on drugs. He wasn't on any drugs. Mm-hmm. But these are the kind of excuses that we get. There's a kid in the Bronx named Remarley Graham who the police followed into his bathroom. They kicked down his door because they said that they thought he was selling marijuana. That's why they went after him. Or it was partly the reason they went after. So the war on drug has provided this sort of environment, this license for law enforcement to interact with Black men and boys in such a way that it too often turns out deadly. Drug effects are predictable. Black men, Black boys' interaction with police are not predictable. Given that situation, I would much rather have my kids interact with drugs because at least I know I can keep them alive and safe because I know there's a number of things that we know about drugs to help keep people safe. I'm not so worried about drugs. I am worried about the police and my boys.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid we're right at the end of our time. But the last thing I wanted to mention, one of the things in your book, because your work is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, a lot needs to happen here, as you have outlined. And you told the story of what somebody, I think it was Ira Glasser from the ACLU, about the fight for justice is not a sprint. It is a marathon relay race, and you cannot see where the track ends. Just run as hard as you can. And I found that so inspirational because it is true in this race and in the race for justice generally, and clearly an inspiration to you. Thank you so very much for your work.
Thank you for having me.
This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Thank you. listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy viernes 4 de marzo del 2022. Cuando David Fishman tuitea, a menudo recibe una avalancha de odio al momento de publicar. Él es un epidemiólogo y médico que ha hablado abiertamente sobre el COVID y la salud pública. Incluso cuando tuitea algo simple, una vez solo para probar su teoría, escribió la afirmación banal: los niños son extraordinarios, y todavía recibió una avalancha de enfados. Pero en los últimos días él notó una tendencia asombrosa